Good afternoon. My name is Jason Crosby, and I am a pastor here at Crescent Hill Baptist Church. And on behalf of this congregation that Helen Graves called a church home on and off for many, many decades, we welcome you to the service this afternoon where we will celebrate her life, which was one that was well lived. Let me begin by offering a word of thanks and gratitude on behalf of Helen's children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren that are present today. Oftentimes in moments such as this, people wonder, what can you do to express your support and care for a family that might be mourning and grieving? Your presence here today communicates so very much. It communicates that you cared for Helen and that you care greatly for those that she cared so greatly for. So thank you for your presence today. I first encountered the Graves family on a hot late May afternoon in 2004. My brother-in-law was roommates with Margaret and David's son, Tom. And we found ourselves on that May afternoon at Earlham College. Tom and Drew, my brother-in-law, had just graduated, but there was just one problem. They needed to be out of their dorm room an hour after graduation, and they had not begun to pack. I know that will not surprise any of you to know that Margaret and David jumped into the fray and began moving couches and boxes and whatever else needed to be hauled out of that dorm room so that the boys would be out before the deadline came. That has been an image of the Graves family that has been repeated many, many times for me. Determination, hard work, faithfulness, caring for one another in a pinch. And I suspect that although I did not have the opportunity to know Helen as well as many of you, that the Graves clan did not come by that by accident. That Helen had a great deal to do with the Graves family being a group of people that are faithful, that are thoughtful, that are kind, that are persistent, and a little tough at times. I'm grateful today that there are so many divine, gracious coincidences that are present today. In addition to the fact that I first met the Graves in 2004 via Tom and my brother-in-law, Helen's son Tom was sharing with me just a few moments ago that there was one person who has been very influential in Tom's life at every point when he's had to make a substantial life decision. That person is none other than Mahan Seiler. Mahan was one of Helen's final pastors in North Carolina. And it just so happens that 20 years ago, Mahan offered me some advice at a very pivotal moment in my life as well. It was 2007, and my wife and I, excuse me, it was 2005. I don't need to mess up my anniversary date or I'll be in trouble. My wife and I were living in Nashville, and I was attending Glendale Baptist Church, where it just so happened that Mahan was interim minister at the time. My wife and I were going to be married later that summer, and so that spring, Mahan offered us premarital counseling. And Mahan, I am convinced, and Kate is as well, that we would still not be together if it weren't for his good guidance. Mahan has been a mentor to me throughout my entire pastoral career, and so I am grateful that our paths cross again today. Thanks to Helen and the Graves family. So today we will continue what we have already begun. I hope that we will continue to remember Helen. Memory is indeed a gift. It is through remembering that a person continues to live on with us in our minds, in our hearts, and in our souls. I hope that we will also continue to identify and proclaim specific ways in which Helen's life made a difference in our lives and our community and our world for the better. I will miss the fact that Helen was such a strident advocate for equal rights for all people. And I lament the fact that she didn't get one of her last wishes granted, which is seeing a woman in the White House. But I'm going to keep working on that. And we also gather today to not only remember her, identify specific attributes that made a difference for the better in our lives about her, but we gather today to remember the promises of the Christian faith, promises which tell us that those who believe in Christ, although we may perish, shall live on forevermore in a place that God has prepared for us, where a feast awaited Helen when she made her way to God's distant shore not long ago. I know Helen believed in those promises, and this day I choose to believe in those too, and take hope and comfort in the fact that those promises tell us that Helen is fully redeemed. She is her best self. She is no longer suffering. She is at peace, and she is in glad reunion with many who have gone there before. Thank you for your presence today. Let us celebrate her life, and let us worship.
It's such a gift to be back at Crescent Hill. And I know the family struggled whether to have the service here with so many roots, but Broadway, that Reba represents, loved her, and she loved Broadway as well. The last few years, Gaga would sometimes say that Janice and Mahan are her longest friends. Not her best friends, but her longest friends. And that may be true, because it began almost 60 years ago when I came here to this congregation as assistant pastor, and the Graves family would always be right over there. That's where it began. And when Gaga moved to Black Mountain, where we're close by, with Cannon and James, these last years, Janice and I just deepened our love for Helen and our friendship. So that's why I have the benefit of being in this role today. Thank you was one of her favorite words. And this is a service of thanksgiving. I can imagine her saying to us here, "Thank you for coming, all of you. Thank you." It's a service of celebration of this magnificent life. But the word contemplation also comes to me. When you contemplate, you focus, you gaze until you recognize the grace and the wonder of the gift. You just gaze until you experience the wonder and the grace of the gift. And that's another way of saying what we're about today, to gaze at this life until we experience in a new way, deeper way, the wonder, the grace of her gift to us and to so many others. Gaga had a way of seeing the silver lining of most things. And that spiritual maturity was honed and formed out of lots of opportunities in her life, but also great sorrow. She was acquainted with grief. At 12, losing her mother after a long illness. At 14, losing her dear sister friend, Mildred. Later, the death of Alan, whom she was married 54 years, the death of her son John, the death of three grandsons, the loss of countless relationships along the way. But she also grieved the loss of institutions she cherished and gave herself to. The loss of the Southern Baptist Convention, the loss of Ridgecrest Baptist Assembly, that she was a sacred place for her as a younger person, and her family went there every year. The loss of two seminaries, Southern Seminary, where Alan was dean, and the loss of Baptist Seminary of Richmond, where her son Tom was president. She was acquainted with grief. And if spiritual maturity comes from great love and great suffering, if it comes from great loving and great suffering, then Helen Graves walked through those doors with grace. And to note the grief of this family, last week we had a service in Black Mountain where her daughter Joyce and her grandson Joe could be, but most of the family, a lot of the family, the Graves family, are here. And we mark and name your grief. Gaga will not be with you in ways she's always been. The stories will not have her voice anymore. And the family reunions, she will not be at the center piece of it. Mary Oliver said, "You shake with joy, you shake with grief. What a time they have, these two housed as they are in the same body. So you shake with joy, you shake with grief." And the rest of us, part of why we're here, is to be with you as best we can. Be a part of the love that carries you, that holds you. A love that's larger than any of us, this mystery love we name God, Spirit, Sacred. All of that, may you feel enfolded in this magnificent presence with you as you shake with joy, as you shake with grief.
I bear the name of Tom Graves, named for my grandfather, my mother's dad. Granddad did not have an easy life himself. He buried two wives. Then, as Mahan said, his younger daughter. He lost all he had in the Depression after paying the medical expenses for his wife and daughter. Life was not easy for that kindly man. But he chose as his favorite verse, and one to be read at his funeral, the same verse and several verses out of Psalm 16 that I read to you now. Mom gave us a lot of great things on which to build a life, but perhaps the most important, coming from her own deep and abiding Christian faith, was an unbounded sense of hope and optimism. Here was a passage read at her dad's funeral, and one that she chose to have read at hers. "The Lord is the portion of mine inheritance, and of my cup thou maintainest my lot." And here was her dad's favorite verse. "The lines of my life are fallen unto me in pleasant places. Yes, I have a goodly heritage. So I will bless the Lord who has given me counsel. My reins also instruct me in the night sessions. I have set the Lord always before me, because he is at my right hand. I shall not be moved. Therefore, my heart is glad, and my glory rejoices. My flesh shall also rest in hope, for thou wilt not leave me to suffer in hell, neither wilt thou suffer the Holy One to see me in corruption. Thou wilt show me the path of life, and in thy presence is the fullness of joy. At your right hand there are pleasures forevermore. The lines of my life have fallen in pleasant places.
Hi. I'm Gaga's great-granddaughter, Sophie, and I'm Gaga's great-granddaughter.
And I'm the brother, Tyler.
We're going to be reading Psalm 121. I look to the mountains. Where will my help come from? My help will come from the Lord, who made heaven and earth. He will not let you fall. Your protector is always awake.
The protector of Israel never dozes or sleeps. The Lord will guard you. He is by your side to protect you. The sun will never hurt you during the day, nor the moon during the night.
The Lord will protect you from all danger. He will keep you safe. He will protect you as you come and as you go, now and forever.
It was more than 50 years ago when I first met Helen Graves. I was new at the seminary, and she's one of the first people I met. She has loved me and encouraged me all these years, and I have been grateful. One of her encouragements was always for women in ministry. She was an advocate for us. And so it gives me great pleasure today to represent Broadway Baptist Church as a woman in ministry, to speak to our love for her. And I see there are several of you here from Broadway, and I know I can say with assurance that we all loved Helen Graves. Now, if you were to visit Helen in the nursing home, the three things would happen. First, you would be welcomed. Welcome, welcome, welcome. And then she would ask a question of whoever came in. The question would be, is Trump still president? Or she might ask, what has Trump done today? There was always something to tell her. And the third thing she would do is quote poetry. She loved poetry and had been memorizing it since her early days in school. And so she could quote many things, and if you're lucky, you didn't get to hear By the Shores of Gitche Guma or Hiawatha or The Midnight Ride of Paul Revere. She knew all the verses to all of these, poems she had learned 90 years before. But over the summer, she became enamored with a little poem called September, written by Helen Hunt Jackson. This is a poem that she learned in first grade, and she said that her teacher would always put the items mentioned in the poem on her desk so that they could see the items and they would increase their knowledge and their vocabulary. So since Alan and Helen died in September, the family has asked me to read the poem, September, by Helen Hunt Jackson. The goldenrod is yellow, the corn is turning brown, the trees in apple orchards with fruit are bending down, the gingiest, bluest fringes are curling in the sun. In dusty pods, the milkweed, its hidden silk, has spun. The sedges flaunt their harvest in every meadow nook, and asters by the brookside make asters in the brook. From dewy lanes at morning, the grape's sweet odors rise. At noon, the roads all flutter with yellow butterflies. By all these lovely tokens, September days are here, with summer's best of weather and autumn's best of cheer. But none of all this beauty, which floods the earth and air, is unto me the secret which makes September fair. 'Tis a thing which I remember, to name it thrills me yet. One day of one September I never can forget.
It's nice to be back home at Crescent Hill Baptist Church. This is where I learned a lot in training union that Mother led, in Sunday school classes where we learned our memory verses and we'd gather at the table back home and each say what memory verses we learned. And I've tried to collect a few in my mind to share with you today that kind of reflect on what Mother believed the Bible was all about and what life should be about. Love one another, bear one another's burdens, hope all things, endure all things. And we heard this one a lot, be peacemakers. So I want to tell you a little bit about what it was like to grow up as a child in Mother's care. One of her first earliest memories, and this kind of is in reference to her constant comment very late in life, you know, like, what dumb thing has Trump done today? She remembered her mother going to vote. In Illinois, women could vote before the amendment passed. So in 1916, her mother went to vote for the first time, and Mother remembers her mother getting all dressed up like she was going to Sunday church to go down and vote for the first time for the President of the United States. She voted for Woodrow Wilson, and after she voted, she came home and told little Helen, who was about 2.5 years old, one day you'll be able to vote for a woman for president. And sure enough, she did. So she really believed in democracy in action, and throughout her life, she believed in democracy in action, and she melded her beliefs in democracy with her Christian beliefs, so that social justice was really what she stood for, and she taught us that. She had a very happy childhood up until a point. She learned to play the piano, and she and her little sister Mildred, who played the clarinet and sang, would perform at church. They would, you know, play for Sunday school classes and that sort of thing. And then their mother took sick. Right after their little baby brother Tommy was born, they moved to El Paso, Texas, because the mother had TB and they needed clearer air than in their coal mining town of southern Illinois, El Dorado. And while they were there in El Paso, which also was where John Arnett's mother went with the same problem, both of their mothers died there. And so they came back to El Dorado, and just over a year later, her sister, who she was very close to, appendix burst, and a year later, she finally died after suffering in the hospital. So Mother went through a lot of pain, and she would came home, and she was a motherless child, and then she became a mother to her little brother. And she dreamed at the time when she could fill her dinner table that she would come home to with lots of children around it. Now, after we were all there, she might have had another dream, but anyway, she had that dream. So she also was a traveler. She loved to travel places. And later in her life, we called her Hot Rod Helen. Now, this might have started out much earlier than we knew. When she was about 14 years old, her dad, who had owned a car sales and had a nice car, She was 14 years old, and her aunt wanted to go down to visit relatives in Missouri. And so her Helen, who was then about this tall, and didn't weigh more than 90 pounds at the time, got in her dad's big car and took her aunt and started driving from southern Illinois down to St. Louis, through St. Louis and on over to visit the cousin. And when she got there, she asked the cousin, why did they still have all those Christmas lights up in St. Louis? And the cousin said, the red and green lights, those are stoplights. So Hot Rod Helen carried on. She lived through the Depression. She went to college, hoping to get a teacher's license so she could come back and earn money. She went on to the WMU training school, married Dad, who she had met at Southern Illinois University. And then she started sitting in classes with Dad at the seminary with A.T. Robertson and other famous theologians. But she, of course, was a woman, so she couldn't get a grade in the class. She sat side by side with Dad and took notes. And a few years later, and a few children later, like after she had three children and was pregnant with David, the fourth, Dad suggested, well, you know, if you need someone to write a book on Bible knowledge, Mom's the one to do it. Let Helen do it. She can do it. And of course, Mother was very happy to do that with three preschoolers and pregnant with the fourth, writing in longhand, Growing in Bible Knowledge, which was an intermediate study course book that actually was translated into at least a couple of languages and used on the mission fields for people who needed to understand what's the Bible all about, because it was very simply put what it was about, and Mother's the one that put it. Now, she didn't have a degree, a PhD in theology, but she knew what was in the Bible, and she put it in her little book. We had an interesting life after David was born. We then moved to Charlottesville, Virginia, where Tom and I were born. And while we were there, Dad was pastor of a very large, prosperous church. The governor of the state actually went there, the First Baptist Church in Charlottesville. And one day, a very esteemed guest had come in on the train, and Mom and Dad had gone down to bring him to our home for a meal. And before the meal said, why don't you go into the restroom and freshen up? And he went into the restroom, and the next thing Mother knew, he was running out of the restroom downstairs being chased by a turkey. Okay, so here he is being chased by a turkey. What was a turkey doing in our bathroom? Well, we also had a brother named John, who was always doing something unexpected. Of course, that could be said of any of us, but on this particular day, John had seen the turkey wandering in the neighborhood and didn't know who it belonged to, so he lassoed it or whatever and got it and put it in our bathroom and went out to look for who owned this turkey. And of course, while that was happening, here comes this esteemed guest. Well, wouldn't you know, that very year, and I don't know whether it was because of the turkey or not, Mrs. Helen Graves, this is the actual clipping from the Charlottesville paper, was named Woman of the Year in Charlottesville. And I don't know if that turkey had anything to do with it, but it notes, we wish to recognize and pay homage to Mrs. Graves and homemakers everywhere whose right living, straight thinking is leading the destiny of our country along the right path. Now, I'm not sure that she would get that now, because she had a lot of thinking that wasn't exactly what people would think would be straight thinking. But anyway, so after living in Virginia for a while, we moved on to Tulsa, and there Dad was pastor of another church, and we were busy in our home that had three stories, and down in the basement was the laundry room, and there was a big laundry chute that came from the second floor down to the basement. And what we liked to do on Saturdays was to get little Tommy and take him upstairs and put him through the laundry chute, and he would come down and land on the load of dirty sheets or whatever was there. Well, he had no idea all of us weren't coming down, because he would just, you know, climb back up the basement stairs, go back up the first floor, go back up the second floor, and go through again, and we'd be there, yay, Tom, you know, coming down there, he'd be at the bottom. Mother had no idea this was going on to the sweetest little baby in Tulsa, Oklahoma, which is what she called Tom at the time. But anyway, that was the laundry chute, and that was Tulsa. Well, in Louisville, Hot Rod Helen got her name, and she got her name because in the springtime, the seminary didn't have the same vacation as the Louisville school system, and so we would go on trips to Florida, and Mother would drive without Dad. Dad was left behind here teaching, and she had a car full of kids. Sometimes we would take friends, maybe some of you all went with us, down to Fort Pierce, Florida. And on the way, halfway through there, you go through Atlanta, Georgia. Well, one night we're driving along, the sun is just fixing to go down, and there's a sign that says turn right to get out of Atlanta and get on down south. Well, Mother took that sign literally, and she turned right. Well, pretty soon we were all doing, you know, we were down in the rail yards. The bridge that we were supposed to turn right on was going over the rail yards, but we were down there. And I remember now the man on the train, and here we are going over all the, it's a change station, and he has his lantern, and he's going back and forth. Get off the tracks, lady! Get off the tracks! And we're there looking out the window. What's our mom done? But we luckily escaped and made it on down to sunny Florida. So that's how Mom got the name Hot Rod Helen, taking us down to Florida every spring vacation. But she also did some other things. We had a fun time growing up. We were always having fun, doing fun things. But she was a very serious leader of our family, too. As we sat around the dinner table, whether it was Sunday after church or at night at 5:30, we'd gather. Dad would come back from the seminary. We would talk about what was going on in the world that day and what our impact was on it, what our thoughts were, what problems there were, and how we would each solve those problems. So we got a good learning experience listening what was going on just at our dinner table. Then one day, right when I was a senior in high school, I was getting ready to go to Atherton, and the phone rang. So I was upstairs. I thought, who's calling right before school? I answered the phone. Hello? May I speak to your father? It was Martin Luther King. He was calling because Dad had communicated with him and given him the phone number when he needed to be picked up to please come pick him up at the airport. Well, not just Dad, but Mom went along with Dad to go and pick up Martin Luther King and bring him to the seminary so he could preach in the chapel, as he had been invited to do by Dad, and then to go and also lecture in Dr. Barnett's ethics classes. Now, Mom knew, and Dad knew, and we certainly knew after that day, because the phone kept ringing, canceling all of Dad's engagements in the South, that act of not just social justice, but that act of love, that act of recognition of who we are as Christians, and how we treat our fellow humans with equality and love and respect, that act changed our lives. But they changed them for the better, because we each became ambassadors under the tutelage of our mother and our father. And then a few years later, David was in Alabama going to college, and I was in Mississippi going to college, and then Tom was in Vanderbilt in Tennessee going to college, and we each lived through the civil rights movement. But we've been brought up in Crescent Hill Church under the tutelage of John Claypool and May Han, and we knew, because of what our mom and dad had taught us, what we were supposed to do. We were supposed to hone to the principles we had learned, love one another, bear one another's burdens, do the right thing. And that's what we did. We'd call Mom and Dad, you know, they're about to kick us out. What should we do? Or should we still go help rebuild the black church that was burned down up the road? You know, what should we do? And what we're doing is because of what you taught us to do. And they did nothing but support us in what we were doing. In one of the letters we just read, from the president of David's College, Dad questioned, has he been anything but a fine Christian gentleman? And this on the edge of a threat to kick him out because he had invited African-American students to college there in Birmingham where he went to school. So she taught us what was right in civil rights. She also taught us what was right as far as women's rights goes. She might not have gotten that degree from the seminary, that PhD in theology, but she still wrote her book on the Bible, and when it came time to go to East Baptist Church and minister to others, she was elected a deacon and served proudly. And she served communion when she was at Trinbrook Nursing Home, and she proudly was a minister to many of you who are here. She believed in women's rights. She believed in women ministries. She believed in the right to choose. I remember a few years ago with Brother David and with Bobby Ann Cox taking Mother in her wheelchair over the age of 100 to be an escort at one of the remaining, I think there's just one now, clinic in Louisville where women who need to have abortions can get them. She knew because her daughter-in-law and her granddaughter had both had to have late-term abortions to save their lives. And if that clinic had been closed and they'd been living in Louisville, where would they have gone? What impact would that have had on their families? She also believed in the right to live with who you love when one of her nieces moved in with her lesbian partner. She let her know she supported her in doing that. And she marched for women the day after the last presidential inauguration. Allie and I, my daughter, were on the Women's March in D.C. And her daughter, Sophie Helen, was marching in New York City, and Hannah Elizabeth was marching with Dawn in San Francisco. And how many of you were marching on that day? You were marching for women's rights. You were marching for equality. You were marching for democracy. You were marching for hope. She was carrying a sign, Eleanor, Hillary, and Michelle, three women who changed the world. So when Mother turned 97 years old, there were 97 days between Valentine's Day and her birthday, and so we called 97 of her friends. Many of you were called, and we asked if you would please call Mother on one of those days, because there's nothing she loved more than to talk to people and hear people call her. It was really hard to take her anyplace during that period of time because she didn't want to miss her phone call. But she got calls from our college roommates, from many of you, friends from far and near, and she cherished those calls because she cherished friendship so much. So here we have her in her later years, macular degeneration. She was blind, but she was a woman of vision. She was motherless, but she became a model mother. She was losing her memory. She couldn't tell you if she'd eaten breakfast that morning or not, but she could tell you the midnight ride of Paul Revere and one if by land and two if by sea. And I have a lantern downstairs that you'll go. I hope you're going to join us for ice cream afterwards. That was her favorite thing to do, have ice cream. And there's a lantern down there that we had in our house. And that lantern reminds me a lot of her life. You think of Hot Rod Helen and the lantern, you know, going across the railroad tracks, but you also think of her being a light in a time of trouble. When you're trying to decide whether to start your country or not, and you're putting one if by land and two if by sea, or you're trying to get your family down to Florida and you're stuck on those railroad tracks and you've got that lantern. Mother was a light for all of us. And I hope that's how you'll remember her. Someone who lit up the world with that sparkle in her eye, with that turn of her head, with the joy she brought to so many, and that challenge for all of us, not only to live with hope, but to work for our democracy, that it too shall bring hope and equality to all. Thank you.
How to share the essence of 52 years with a grandmother who was as certain about UFOs as she was about Jesus, who had an extraordinary capacity for generosity and also to hold a grudge, who was never a sports fan, but who lived every day with a full game-on spirit. My husband Jeff informed me that this level of conviction is actually genetic, declaring many times in the early days of our marriage he might as well have married a surgeon. Not always right, but never in doubt. So I thought, in preparing for today, why not let Gaga have the last word, again, one more time, by sharing her thoughts and reflections in her final days. As usual, she provided ample material, primarily during a 28-hour marathon stream of consciousness the night before she went to hospice. First of all, a familiar story from the past about how she and Gran, despite not having had the benefit of Mahan's premarital counseling, had never had an argument in all their 59 years. Though in this more fluid telling, she confessed if they ever were to have been divorced, it would have been during a move. When I probed her about this never-before-divulged hint of discord, she really caught my attention when she replied, "Oh yes, whenever we had a disagreement, we would just swing it out." But thankfully, she quickly expounded on how they would simply head to the porch swing to talk things over, swinging and laughing until they'd found common ground on whatever had come between them. The day after this cathartic release, which was also the first day that she didn't get out of bed, she was neither despairing nor depleted. As Mahan sat beside her, seeking closure on how much there was to celebrate in her past, she shot right back, and so much to look forward to. Thankfully, she couldn't see me rolling my eyes beside her. But sure enough, she was spot on, right yet again. In her final week, she relished long days in the hospice garden with a late summer breeze in her hair, a private harp concert, the loving voices and warm touch of family and close friends always beside her. She was so thankful. Thank you for bringing me on this vacation. Indeed, there had been much to look forward to, as in her brief waking moments, she described each day as just perfect. Toward the end of that sleepless night of activation in the nursing home, I asked her if she didn't think it might be a good idea to get a little rest, to stop talking and just catch her breath a bit. And she said, "Why, I've been trying over 100 years to stop talking, and and I'm not done yet." So on we went into the next morning, by which time her only remaining anxiety seemed to be linked to the future. For someone whose milestone birthday wishes were to ditch Mitch and dump Trump, leaving things in their hands was almost more than she could bear. During her last conversations with faraway family that afternoon, she kept repeating over and over the importance of working together with those social justice causes in community. She was telling Mom she needed to write a book on finding purpose in retirement. On the following evening, after her first full day at hospice, spent outside by a beautiful fountain, she told the staff she wasn't ready to go back in, not until the stars came out. And while she knew enough not to disclose her wish, I have no doubt she was thinking not of herself, but those of us she was leaving behind. So if you want to say with me, starlight, star bright, first star I see tonight, I wish I may, I wish I might, have the wish I wish tonight. She was wishing for us that we would swing it out with those we love, celebrate the heart and meaning in each and every day, and no matter how dire the situation, look to the heavens for hope and comfort. Amen, Gaga.
Lord, take my hand, lead me on, let me stand. I am tired, I am weak, I am worn. Through the storm, through the night, lead me on to the light. Take my hand, precious Lord, lead me home. When my way grows drear, precious Lord, linger near. When my life is almost gone, take my hand, precious Lord, lead me home. When the darkness appears and the day is past and gone, at the river I stand, guide my feet, hold my hand, take my hand, precious Lord, lead.
So much in a life to celebrate. And thank you for Reba and Jenny, Laura especially. See if we can put some frame around this life. William Stanford, the poet, says, there's a thread you follow. It goes among things that change, but it doesn't change. Change. My, you've sensed the changes that Helen experienced in her 105 years. At first grade, there was the change from slates to writing on notepads. And you heard about the change at four, her mother voting for the first time. And the stoplight story that came up, you know, that she thought were Christmas decorations. So as Tom said when I talked to him, he said, I can't think of a person who've experienced more change, adapted to more change, than she did. But what's the thread in all those changes? What's the thread that doesn't change when everything else changes? I wondered about that. I want you to wonder with me, but I thought, well, she was such a Bible student. She wrote that book about growing in Bible knowledge. And the thread I think we need to search for needs to be a verse from the scripture. So what I thought was Micah's famous words of what does God require? What does God require for human beings? To do justice, to love kindness, and walk humbly with God. Let's play with that as a thread that runs through all these stories that we've already enjoyed. Doing justice, just relationships, righteousness, right relationships. And that passion for justice seemed to be in her DNA. She grew up in families that were about justice and mercy. And as we've heard, she, with Alan, has created and formed this family that cared about, and with other church families, cared about God so loved the world. I mean, she means the world, all of it, the mountains and the streams and the flowers, the plants, the people, all the people, the human beings and the non-human beings. She took seriously, as you heard. You love it all. You love it all. And with Alan, she created this family, among other church families who had that passion. You can touch this web of the Graves family. You touch any one person in the Graves family, and you're going to feel the energy of this passion for justice. Now, she was a Baptist, and in her later years, I heard a lot of the stories. You know, Jesus was a Baptist, she said. He was baptized by John the Baptist and would add, certainly not a Presbyterian. And she said that Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton were good leaders because they were shaped by training union in their Baptist upbringing. And training union was a program, as you many of you know, to how to speak publicly and that kind of thing. But she wasn't a fundamentalist Baptist. She is what I would call a relational Baptist. She was about fairness, just relationships. And it seemed like that core of her about fairness, justice, just kept growing in her life. It just kept, her heart kept enlarging to include more and more people who were left out, who were oppressed, who were on the margin. It just seems like that never ceased. And you heard her protesting the war. I think that's one of the stories. But her commitment to women in leadership, and her time with protesting with David, with the sign that said, "Yeah, support our men in Vietnam. Bring them home." That was her part. So many examples, some of which you've heard about this passion for justice. It's a thread she followed. It went among things that change, but it didn't change. The last big upset I heard her talk about was what was happening to children who were being separated from their parents at the border. It was a thread she followed. And then there was the loving kindness. Or as Peterson translates that, it's loyalty in your loving, compassionate. Now, the examples of her doing kindness, you know, are like shells scattered on the seashore. There's no way to name many of them, but just to name that trait of her life, if you knew her, you're thinking of some examples. Now, she loved education, committed to education. She helped with Alan in his education. And she could teach, loved teaching. When they did some work in the seminary in Nigeria, she said, "Where are the wives of these pastors?" And so she would teach the wives. So she was committed as a teacher, but she didn't identify primarily as a teacher. She was a writer, loving poems, as we've heard. But she didn't identify herself primarily as a writer. She would speak out and write out around justice concerns, but she didn't define herself as a prophet. She was defined by many so-called little acts of kindness, loyal in her kindnesses. One story that I didn't know until just recently, when a student at seminary and his wife were killed in a car accident, they take in, Alan and Helen take in the two girls for 2 years. If you were to ask Alan about that, she'd say, that's just what you do. Nothing special. Little acts of kindness. Toward the end, when she was with James and Cannon, she recognized that maybe she was too much of a burden on them, and she says, "Put me over in some other place." And she went to Highland. And there she scattered more seeds of little kindness. And last week when we had the service, we had two stories from two who tended to her. Russ was one. He said, I've changed the way I relate to the elderly here because of Gaga. Seeds. She got it that the main metaphors of Jesus were all about the transforming power of the small. Leaven, a piece of grain, a cup of cold water, a pinch of salt, a little light, a little bread and cup, the power of little acts of kindness. And the harvest of that we've been talking about. She got it. And I stopped there just for a minute to say she's got a gift to give us. I think many of us here, maybe most of us, can easily despair over what's happening in our nation, in our world, and we get overwhelmed. It's kind of like the fisher's prayer. We say, "God, help us. The sea is so great, but my boat is so small. And what difference can I make? What can I do that matters?" We can learn from Helen. She just went about throwing out seeds. Many acts of kindnesses. And we can do that. We can do that. And not worry so much about measuring our outcome. We can love kindnesses and be loyal in our loving with kindness. It's a thread she followed. It went among many things that changed, but it didn't change. And then the walking humbly with God, as has been noted, she walked with a sense of God, a sense of presence, a faith. She was a faith person, solid and confident in her relationship to God. And she didn't limp with uncertainty. She didn't run with desperation. She just kind of walked steadily out of her sense of her faith in God. And she walked with humility. I think humility and gratitude are kind of two sides of the same coin. I've never met a person who's humble that's not also grateful. I've never met a grateful person who was not also humble. She got it, that we really are made from the products of gifts, that we have nothing that hasn't been given to us. She was grateful. Yes, we have to unpack the gifts responsibly, but she understood. It's all grace, it's all gift. And as a person of some age, what I learned most from Gaga in these last years was she defined for me the fruition of life, the goal of aging, the pinnacle of a life well lived. We all are grateful. At times, thanks, we say thank you. But for Gaga, for Helen, gratitude was a state of being. She was a grateful, a person. And so her thank yous that were frequent and the welcomes just came out of a natural spot of her getting to the place of just being thankful. Her last words to me, I leaned over and kissed her on the forehead, and she says, "Thank you." And sometimes it's thank you, thank you, thank you. So that was a thread she followed, walking steadily as a person of faith who knew humility and gratitude. There's a thread you follow. It goes among things that change, but it doesn't change. And people ask you about the thread, but they can't see it. While you hold it, though, you cannot be lost. Tragedies happen. People get hurt and die, and you suffer, and you grow old. But nothing you do can stop life's unfolding. Nothing you do can stop time's unfolding. But you don't ever let go of the thread. Nothing can you do can stop life unfolding. But don't ever let go of the thread. She didn't. Let's don't either. Amen.
Thank you.
for the benediction, let me just encourage you to be a part of the reception. As was mentioned, ice cream would just tickle Gaga to death that we enjoyed ice cream at her funeral. And to hang around, we'll have it where it's easy to sit with the ice cream and tell some Helen Gaga stories. I hope you can be a part of that part of our coming together. Now the benediction. Go forth from this place, remembering what you've experienced. Friends and family of Helen Graves, go giving thanks for the difference we are because she lived among us. Go to extend and continue her thread of passion for justice, loyalty in loving kindnesses, and walking humbly with God. As Gaga would say, thank you, thank you, thank you. Let's go in peace.